Chapter 7 Mice. Townsend, the sheep buyer, who had brought Ogion's message to the farm in Middle Valley, came out one afternoon to the major's house.
"Will you be selling the goats now, Lord Ogion's gone?"
"I might," Tanar said neutrally. She had in fact been wondering how, if she stayed in Ray Albi, she would get on. Like any wizard, Ogion had been supported by the people his skills and powers served, in his case, anyone on Gaunt. He had only to ask, and what he needed would be given gratefully. A good bargain for the goodwill of a mage. But he never had to ask. Rather, he had to give away the excess of food and raiment and tools and livestock and all necessities and ornaments that were offered or simply left on his doorstep.
"What shall I do with them?" he would demand, perplexed, standing with his arms full of indignant squawking chickens, or yards of tapestry, or pots of pickled beets.
But Tenar had left her living in the Middle Valley. She had not thought when she left so suddenly of how long she might stay. She had not brought with her the 7 pieces of ivory, Flint's hoard, nor would that money have been of use in the village, except to buy land or livestock, or deal with some trader up from Gaunt Port, peddling Palawi furs, or silks of Lorbaneri to the rich farmers and little lords of Gaunt. Flint's farm gave her all she and Tharoon needed to eat and wear. But Ogion's 6 goats and his beans and onions had been for his pleasure rather than his need. She had been living off his larder, the gifts of villagers who gave to her for his sake, and the generosity of Auntie Moss. Just yesterday the witch had said,
"Dearie, my ringneck hen's brood's hatched out, and I'll bring you 2-3 chickens when they begin to scratch." The mage wouldn't keep 'em, too noisy and silly, he said. But what's a house without chickies at the door?
Indeed, her hens wandered in and out of Moss's door freely and slept on her bed, and enriched the smells of the dark, smoky, reeking room beyond belief.
"There's a brown and white yearling nanny will make a fine milch goat,"
Tanar said to the sharp-faced man.
"I was thinking of the whole lot," he said. "Maybe. Only 5 or 6 of them, right?"
6. They're in the pasture up there if you want to have a look."
"I'll do that."
But he didn't move. No eagerness, of course, was to be evinced on either side.
"Seen the great ship come in?" he asked.
Ogion's house looked west and north, and from it one could see only the rocky headlands at the mouth of the bay, the armed cliffs. But from the village itself, at several places, one could look down the steep back-and-forth road to Gaunt Port, and see the docks and the whole harbour. Ship-watching was a regular pursuit in Ray Albi. There were generally a couple of old men on the bench behind the smithy, which gave the best view, and though they might never in their lives have gone down the 15 zigzag miles of that road to Gaunt Port, they watched the comings and goings of ships as a spectacle, strange yet familiar, provided for their entertainment.
"From Havnar," Smith's boy said. "He was down in port bargaining for ingots. Come up yester evening late. The great ship's from Havnar Great Port," he said.
He was probably talking to keep her mind off the price of goats, and the slyness of his look was probably simply the way his eyes were made. But Havnar Great Port traded little with Gaunt, a poor and remote island notable only for wizards, pirates and goats. And something in the words, "the great ship," troubled or alarmed her. She did not know why.
"He said they say there's a king in Havnar now,"
the sheep buyer went on with a sidelong glance.
"That might be a good thing," said Tanar.
Townsend nodded.
"Might keep the foreign riffraff out."
Tanar nodded her foreign head pleasantly.
"But there's those down in port won't be pleased, maybe."
He meant the pirate sea captains of Gaunt, whose control of the northeastern seas had been increasing of late years to the point where many of the old trade schedules with the central islands of the archipelago had been disrupted or abandoned. This impoverished everyone on Gaunt except the pirates. But that did not prevent the pirates from being heroes in the eyes of most Gauntish men. For all she knew, Tanar's son was a sailor on a pirate ship. And safer, maybe, as such than on a steady merchantman. Better shark than herring, as they said. There's some who are never pleased, no matter what, Tanar said, automatically following the rules of conversation, but impatient enough with them that she added, rising, I'll show you the goats. You can have a look. I don't know if we'll sell all or any. And she took the man to the broom pasture gate and left him. She did not like him. It wasn't his fault that he had brought her bad news once, and maybe twice, but his eyes slid, and she did not like his company. She wouldn't sell him Ogion's goats, not even Sippy. After he had left, bargainless, she found herself uneasy. She had said to him, I don't know if we'll sell, and that had been foolish to say we instead of I, when he hadn't asked to speak to Sparrowhawk, hadn't even alluded to him, as a man bargaining with a woman was more than likely to do, especially when she was refusing his offer. She did not know what they made of Sparrowhawk, of his presence and non-presence in the village. Ogion, aloof and silent, and in some ways feared, had been their own mage and their fellow villager. Sparrowhawk they might be proud of as a name, the arch-mage who had lived a while in Rhae Alby and done wonderful things, fooling a dragon in the 90 Isles, bringing the ring of Aereth Akbe back from somewhere or other. But they did not know him, nor did he know them. He had not gone into the village since he came, only to the forest, the wilderness. She had not thought about it before, but he avoided the village as surely as Theroux did. They must have talked about him. It was a village, and people talked. But gossip about the doings of wizards and mages would not go far. The matter was too uncanny. The lives of men of power were too strange, too different from their own. Let be, she had heard villagers in the Middle Valley say when somebody got to speculating too freely about a visiting weather worker or their own wizard beach. Let be, he goes his way, not ours. As for herself, that she should have stayed on to nurse and serve such a man of power would not seem a questionable matter to them. Again, it was a case of let be. She had not been very much in the village herself. They were neither friendly nor unfriendly to her. She had lived there once in Weaver Fan's cottage. She was the old mage's ward. He had sent Townsend down round the mountain for her. All that was very well. But then she had come with the child. Terrible to look at. Who'd walk about in daylight with it by choice? And what kind of woman would be a wizard's pupil, a wizard's nurse? Witchery there, sure enough, and foreign, too. But all the same, she was wife to a rich farmer way down there in the Middle Valley, though he was dead and she a widow. Well, who could understand the ways of the witch folk? Let be. Better let be. She met the Archmage of Earthsea as he came past the garden fence. She said, They say there's a ship in from the city of Havna. He stopped. He made a movement, quickly controlled, but it had been the beginning of a turn to run, to break, and run like a mouse from a hawk. Ged, she said, what is it?
I can't, he said. I can't face them.
Who?
Men from him. From the king.
His face had gone greyish, as when he was first here, and he looked around for a place to hide. His terror was so urgent and undefended that she thought only how to spare him. "You needn't see them. If anybody comes, I'll send them away. Come back to the house now. You haven't eaten all day."
"There was a man there," he said.
"Townsend, pricing goats. I sent him away. Come on." He came with her, and when they were in the house, she shut the door. "They couldn't harm you, surely, Ged. Why would they want to?" He sat down at the table and shook his head dully.
"No. No."
"Do they know you're here?"
"I don't know."
"What is it you're afraid of?" she asked, not impatiently, but with some rational authority. He put his hands across his face, rubbing his temples and forehead, looking down.
"I was," he said. "I'm not..."
It was all he could say. She stopped him, saying, "All right, it's all right." She dared not touch him lest she worsen his humiliation by any semblance of pity. She was angry at him and for him. "It's none of their business," she said, "where you are or who you are or what you choose to do or not to do. If they come prying, they can leave curious." That was Lark saying. She had a pang of longing for the company of an ordinary, sensible woman. "Anyhow, the ship may have nothing at all to do with you. They may be chasing pirates home. It'll be a good thing, too, when the king gets around to doing that. I found some wine in the back of the cupboard, a couple of bottles. I wonder how long Ogion had it squirreled away there. I think we'd both do well with a glass of wine and some bread and cheese. The little one's had her dinner and gone off with Heather to catch frogs. There may be frog's legs for supper, but bread and cheese for now, and wine. I wonder where it's from. Who brought it to Ogion? How old it is?" So she talked along, woman's babble, saving him from having to make any answer or misread any silence, until he had got over the crisis of shame and eaten a little and drunk a glass of the old, soft red wine.
"It's best I go, Tanar," he said, "till I learn to be what I am now."
"Go where?"
"Up on the mountain."
"Wandering? Like Ogion?" She looked at him. She remembered walking with him on the roads of Atuan, deriding him. "Do wizards often beg?" And he had answered, "Yes, but they tried to give something in exchange." She asked cautiously, "Could you get on for a while as a weather worker or a finder?" She filled his glass full. He shook his head. He drank wine and looked away.
"No," he said. "None of that. Nothing of that."
She did not believe him. She wanted to rebel, to deny, to say to him, "How can it be? How can you say that? As if you'd forgotten all you know, all you learned from Ogion and at Roke and in your travelling. You can't have forgotten the words, the names, the acts of your art. You learned, you earned your power." She kept herself from saying that. But she murmured, "I don't understand. How can it all?"
"A cup of water,"
he said, tipping his glass a little, as if to pour it out, and after a while,
"What I don't understand is why he brought me back. The kindness of the young is cruelty. So I'm here. I have to get on with it. Till I can go back."
She did not know clearly what he meant, but she heard a note of blame or complaint that in him shocked and angered her. She spoke stiffly. "It was Carlescent that brought you here." It was dark in the house with the door closed, and only the small western window letting in the late afternoon light. She could not make out his expression, but presently he raised his glass to her with a shadowy smile and drank.
"This wine," he said, Some great merchant or pirate must have brought it to Ogeon. I never drank its equal, even in Havnar.
He turned the squat glass in his hands, looking down at it.
I'll call myself something, he said, and go across the mountain to Armouth and the East Forest country where I came from. They'll be making hay. There's always work at haying and harvest.
She did not know how to answer. Fragile and ill-looking, he would be given such work only out of charity or brutality, and if he got it, he would not be able to do it. The roads aren't like they used to be, she said. These last years, there's thieves and gangs everywhere. Foreign riffraff, as my friend Townsend says. But it's not safe anymore to go alone. Looking at him in the dusky light, to see how he took this, she wondered sharply for a moment what it must be like never to have feared a human being. What it would be like to have to learn to be afraid.
Ogeon still went, he began,
and then set his mouth. He had recalled that Ogeon had been a mage. Down in the south part of the island, Tanar said, there's a lot of herding. Sheep, goats, cattle. They drive them up into the hills before the long dance and pasture them there until the rains. They're always needing herders. She drank a mouthful of the wine. It was like the dragon's name in her mouth. But why can't you just stay here?
Not in Ogeon's house. The first place they'll come.
Well, what if they do come? What will they want of you?
To be what I was.
The desolation of his voice chilled her. She was silent, trying to remember what it was like to have been powerful, to be the Eaten One, the one priestess of the tombs of Atuan, and then to lose that, throw it away, become only Tanar, only herself. She thought about how it was to have been a woman in the prime of life, with children and a man, and then to lose all that, becoming old and a widow, powerless. But even so, she did not feel she understood his shame, his agony of humiliation. Perhaps only a man could feel so. A woman got used to shame. Or maybe Auntie Moss was right, and when the meat was out, the shell was empty. Witch thoughts, she thought. And to turn his mind and her own, and because the soft, fiery wine made her wits and tongue quick, she said, do you know, I've thought about Ogeon teaching me, and I wouldn't go on, but went and found myself, my farmer, and married him. I thought, when I did that, I thought on my wedding day, Ged will be angry when he hears of this. She laughed as she spoke.
I was,
he said. She waited. He said,
I was disappointed.
Angry, she said.
Angry, he said.
He poured her glass full.
I had the power to know power then, he said. And you shone in that terrible place. The labyrinth, that darkness.
Well then tell me, what should I have done with my power and the knowledge Ogeon tried to teach me?
Use it.
How?
As the art magic is used.
By whom?
Wizards, he said,
a little painfully. Magic means the skills, the arts of wizards, of mages?
What else would it mean?
Is that all it could ever mean? He pondered, glancing up at her once or twice. When Ogeon taught me, she said, here at the hearth, there, the words of the old speech, they were as easy and as hard in my mouth as in his. That was like learning the language I spoke before I was born. But the rest, the lore, the runes of power, the spells, the rules, the raising of the forces, that was all dead to me. Somebody else's language. I used to think I could be dressed up as a warrior, with a lance and a sword and a plume and all. But it wouldn't fit, would it? What would I do with the sword? Would it make me a hero? I'd be myself in clothes that didn't fit, is all. Hardly able to walk. She sipped her wine. So I took it all off, she said, and put on my own clothes.
What did Ogion say when you left him?
What did Ogion usually say? That roused the shadowy smile again. He said nothing. She nodded. After a while, she went on more softly. He took me because you brought me to him. He wanted no prentice after you, and he never would have taken a girl but from you at your asking. But he loved me. He did me honor, and I loved and honored him. But he couldn't give me what I wanted, and I couldn't take what he had to give me. He knew that. But, Ged, it was a different matter when he saw Tharoo. The day before he died, you say, and Moss says, that power knows power. I don't know what he saw in her, but he said, teach her. And he said, Ged waited. He said, they will fear her. And he said, teach her all, not Roke. I don't know what he meant. How can I know? If I had stayed here with him, I might know. I might be able to teach her. But I thought Ged will come. He'll know. He'll know what to teach her, what she needs to know, my wronged one.
I do not know, he said, speaking very low. I saw in the child, I see only the wrong done, the evil.
He drank off his wine.
I have nothing to give her, he said.
There was a little scraping knock at the door. He started up instantly with that same helpless turn of the body, looking for a place to hide. Tenar went to the door, opened it a crack, and smelled Moss before she saw her.
Men in the village, the old woman whispered dramatically. All kind of fine folk come up from the port, from the great ship that's in from Hafner City, they say. Come after the Archmage, they say.
He doesn't want to see them, Tenar said weakly. She had no idea what to do.
I dare say not, said the witch,
and after an expectant pause,
where is he then?
Here, said Sparrowhawk, coming to the door and opening it wider. Moss eyed him and said nothing.
Do they know where I am?
Not from me, Moss said.
If they come here, said Tenar, all you have to do is send them away. After all, you are the Archmage. Neither he nor Moss was paying attention to her.
They won't come to my house, Moss said. Come on, if you like.
He followed her, with a glance but no word to Tenar.
But what am I to tell them? She demanded. Nothing, dearie, said the witch.
Heather and Tharoo came back from the marshes with 7 dead frogs in a net bag, and Tenar busied herself cutting off and skinning the legs for the hunter's supper. She was just finishing when she heard voices outside, and looking up at the open door saw people standing at it. Men in hats, a twist of gold, a glitter.
Mistress Gohar, said a civil voice.
Come in, she said. They came in. 5 men, seeming twice as many in the low-ceilinged room, and tall and grand. They looked about them, and she saw what they saw. They saw a woman standing at a table, holding a long, sharp knife. On the table was a chopping board, and on that, to one side, a little heap of naked greenish-white legs. To the other, a heap of fat, bloody, dead frogs. In the shadow behind the door, something lurked. A child, but a child deformed, mismade, half-faced, claw-handed. On a bed in an alcove beneath the single window sat a big, bony young woman staring at them with her mouth wide open. Her hands were bloody and muddy, and her dank skirt smelled of marsh water. When she saw them look at her, she tried to hide her face with her skirt, baring her legs to the thigh. They looked away from her and from the child, and there was no one else to look at but the woman with the dead frogs.
"Mistress Gohar," one of them repeated.
"So I'm called," she said.
"We come from Havnar, from the king," said the civil voice.
She could not see his face clearly against the light.
"We seek the Archmage Sparrowhawk of Gaunt. King Lebanon is to be crowned at the turn of autumn, and he seeks to have the Archmage, his lord and friend, with him to make ready for the coronation and to crown him, if he will."
The man spoke steadily and formally, as to a lady in a palace. He wore sober breeches of leather and a linen shirt dusty from the climb up from Gaunt Port, but it was fine cloth, with embroidery of gold thread at the throat. "He's not here," Tanar said. A couple of little boys from the village peered in at the door and drew back, peered again, fled shouting.
"Maybe you can tell us where he is, Mistress Gohar," said the man.
"I cannot." She looked at them all, the fear of them she had felt at first, caught from Sparrowhawk's panic, perhaps, or mere foolish fluster at seeing strangers, was subsiding. Here she stood in Ogion's house, and she knew well enough why Ogion had never been afraid of great people. "You must be tired after that long road," she said. "Will you sit down? There's wine. Here, I must wash the glasses." She carried the chopping board over to the sideboard, put the frog's legs in the larder, scraped the rest into the swill pail that Heather would carry to Weaver Fan's pigs, washed her hands and arms and the knife at the basin, poured fresh water and rinsed out the two glasses she and Sparrowhawk had drunk from. There was one other glass in the cabinet and two clay cups without handles. She set these on the table and poured wine for the visitors. There was just enough left in the bottle to go round. They had exchanged glances and had not sat down. The shortage of chairs excused that. The rules of hospitality, however, bound them to accept what she offered. Each man took glass or cup from her with a polite murmur. Saluting her, they drank.
"My word," said one of them.
"Andrades, the late harvest," said another with round eyes.
A third shook his head.
"Andrades, the dragon year," he said solemnly.
The fourth nodded and sipped again, reverent. The fifth, who was the first to have spoken, lifted his clay cup to Tanar again and said,
"You honour us with a king's wine, mistress."
"It was Ogion's," she said. "This was Ogion's house. This is Ihal's house." "You knew that, my lords?"
"We did, mistress. The king sent us to this house, believing that the Archmage would come here, and when word of the death of its master came to Roke and Havnar, yet more certain of it. But it was a dragon that bore the Archmage from Roke, and no word or sending has come from him since then to Roke or to the king. And it is much in the king's heart, and much in the interest of us all, to know the Archmage is here and is well. Did he come here, mistress?"
"I cannot say," she said. But it was a poor equivocation, repeated, and she could see that the men thought so. She drew herself up, standing behind the table. I mean that I will not say. I think if the Archmage wishes to come, he will come. If he wishes not to be found, you will not find him. Surely you will not seek him out against his will? The oldest of the men and the tallest said,
The king's will is ours.
The first speaker said more conciliatingly,
We are only messengers. What is between the king and the Archmage of the Isles is between them. We seek only to bring the message and the reply.
If I can, I will see that your message reaches him.
And the reply? The oldest man demanded.
She said nothing, and the first speaker said,
We'll be here some few days at the house of the Lord of Rhaealbi, who, hearing of our ship's arrival, offered us his hospitality.
She felt a sense of a trap laid, or a noose tightening, though she did not know why. Sparrowhawk's vulnerability, his sense of his own weakness, had infected her. Distraught, she used the defense of her appearance, her seeming to be a mere goodwife, a middle-aged housekeeper. But was it seeming? It was also truth, and these matters were more subtle even than the guises and shape changes of wizards. She ducked her head and said, That will be more befitting your lordship's comfort. You see, we live very plain here, as the old mage did.
And drink Andrade's wine, said the one who had identified the vintage,
a bright-eyed, handsome man with a winning smile. She, playing her part, kept her head down, but as they took their leave and filed out, she knew that, seem what she might and be what she might, if they did not know now that she was Tanar of the Ring, they would know it soon enough, and so would know that she herself knew the Archmage, and was indeed their way to him, if they were determined to seek him out. When they were gone, she heaved a great sigh. Heather did so too, and then finally shut her mouth, which had hung open all the time they were there.
I never, she said, in a tone of deep, replete satisfaction, and went to see where the goats had got to.
Theru came out from the dark place behind the door, where she had barricaded herself from the strangers with Ogion's staff, and Tanar's alder stick, and her own hazel switch. She moved in the tight, sidling way she had mostly abandoned since they had been here, not looking up, the ruined half of her face bent down toward the shoulder. Tanar went to her and knelt to hold her in her arms. Theru, she said, they won't hurt you. They mean no harm. The child would not look at her. She let Tanar hold her like a block of wood. If you say so, I won't let them in the house again. After a while, the child moved a little and asked in her hoarse, thick voice,
What will they do to Sparrowhawk?
Nothing, Tanar said. No harm. They come. They mean to do him honor. But she had begun to see what their attempt to do him honor would do to him. Denying his loss, denying him his grief for what he had lost, forcing him to act the part of what he was no longer. When she let the child go, Theru went to the closet and fetched out Ogion's broom. She laboriously swept the floor where the men from Havnar had stood, sweeping away their footprints, sweeping the dust of their feet out the door, off the doorstep. Watching her, Tanar made up her mind. She went to the shelf where Ogion's three great books stood and rummaged there. She found several goose quills and a half-dried-up bottle of ink, but not a scrap of paper or parchment. She set her jaw heating to do damage to anything so sacred as a book, and scored and tore out a thin strip of paper from the blank end sheet of the Book of Runes. She sat at the table and dipped the pen and wrote. Neither the ink nor the words came easy. She had scarcely written anything since she had sat at this same table a quarter of a century ago, with Ogion looking over her shoulder, teaching her the runes of Hardik and the great runes of power. She wrote, "Go, Oak Farm, in Middle Valley, to Clearbrook. Say Gohar sent to look to garden and sheep." It took her nearly as long to read it over as it had to write it. By now, Tharu had finished her sweeping and was watching her intent. She added one word. Tonight. "Where's Heather?" she asked the child as she folded the paper on itself once and twice. "I want her to take this to Auntie Moss's house." She longed to go herself, to see Sparrowhawk, but dared not be seen going lest they were watching her to lead them to him.
"I'll go,"
Tharu whispered. Tinar looked at her sharply. "You'll have to go alone, Tharu. Past the village." The child nodded. "Give it only to him." She nodded again. Tinar tucked the paper into the child's pocket, held her, kissed her, let her go. Tharu went, not crouching and sidling now, but running freely, flying. Tinar thought, seeing her vanish in the evening light beyond the dark doorframe, flying like a bird, a dragon, a child, free.